listening to State of the Arts with Michael Sterling and Paul Strolley, right here on LA Talk Radio.
I'm Michael Sterling.
And I am Paul Strolley, and welcome to State of the Arts. Michael, are we having technical difficulties?
Slightly in my right ear, yes.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, is it you or is it the headphones? Because let's face it, you're not a spring chicken.
That's at least you had to remind me in front of our distinguished guests. You have to say that, right? It actually is the headset, but I think it's clearing itself up.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So it's the headset, yes.
Yeah.
I have the same feeling when I sit on a bar stool, and I'm like, did the stools get smaller? Is that it? They used to be so plush. No, maybe it's me. Maybe I'm a little
now
plush.
Now something else is plush, right?
Yeah.
You know, Paul, we have some wonderful people with us.
Yes, we do.
In this edition of State of the Arts, today we have one of music's most prolific composers. He is not only a Grammy and Emmy Award winner and a two-time Academy Award nominee. Am I correct?
You're right, yeah.
Yes, and he is... has written some of music's most memorable melodies. He's also an author whose memoirs, Killing Me Softly, My Life in Music, has just been published.
Right, exactly.
Charles Fox, welcome to State of the Arts.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here with both of you.
Well, we're so happy to have you here.
Pleasure to have you here, Charles. And also, we have former Broadway and television dancer and choreographer, and I'm dying to talk to you about the whole Carol Burnett thing, because I was fascinated by that, who in more recent years has also become a very successful director of theater here in Los Angeles. His current assignment is directing the Group Rep Company's next offering of a Neil Simon classic comedy, truly one of his best, if not his best, Barefoot in the Park. Stan Mason is with us. Stan, do I have that right?
Truly a classic, and I am really glad to be here.
I
could have been home taking care of a hangnail. this is fine.
Welcome,
Stan.
Oh,
we're starting there, are we?
We are. And yes. as always, we are honored to say that State of the Arts is powered by Breakdown Services, a global communications network and casting system that provides the most professional means to reach talent agents as well as actors when casting a project. To learn more about Breakdown Services, visit them at breakdownexpress.com.
And we'd also like to acknowledge performingartslive.com, who so generously support our live arts calendar, which will be featured later in the program. Always a highlight of the show to let everyone know what is going on in Los Angeles, including Barefoot in the Park, which we will talk about. But, Michael, how was your week?
You know, it was pretty tasty. It was busy.
Yeah?
It was busy, and I must say I had a little incident the other night that was interesting. I've never encountered this before. I was actually going to the opening of a new show that was playing, that was opening on Saturday evening, and I was handling the press for it, so I had to be there at a specific time. And as I'm leaving, I'm going to the theater, which is out here in the San Fernando Valley in Burbank, and I decided not to take the freeway, but to take an alternate street going east and west,
yes,
that I'd never been on before.
Right.
And I guess I discovered why, because I came to a stoplight. And you know, Charles, now, I look kind of distinguished, don't I?
My first impression of you.
Really? Yes. Really? I like him even more. I like
If by distinguished you mean foppish, yes, very much so.
Really? Six months ago, I was driving a Chrysler 300. That was pretty much my car, right? And I stopped in a Ford dealership, and I went in to look at the new Ford Fusion, you know, which is Motor Trend's Car of the Year 2010. It's a beautiful car.
Why do I think you're getting a check? Why do I think you're getting money from the Ford people?
No. I am giving Ford money. I had no intention of buying this car, but after spending an hour with one of the sales force there, I ended up 4 hours later driving off the Ford Fusion, you know, off the lot. So now it skews much younger. It's a much younger car for younger people.
Very sporty. Yes.
Very sporty.
Very sporty.
All the bells and whistles. It's the car that talks to you. You know, it's very snappy. And I'm driving down the street. Come to a
sadly, spotlight. What it says is you're too old to be driving. That's what it says.
On more than one occasion. And I come to a stoplight, and I notice that there's a car next to me that is kind of revving up. It is getting ready, you know, it's kind of jumping the gun. It's getting ready to take a flight here when the light turns green, and when the light turns green, it does. And I happened to go at the speed that I thought was appropriate for myself and happened to be a little bit faster than that car. And that car cut in front of me to cut me off. Right. And I was what I was going through was a challenge.
Yeah.
Right? It's like it was out of Greece. I suddenly felt like it was in a production of Greece, right?
Going. You have to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. You were challenged to a drag race.
Challenged to a drag race.
Dangerous in L.A.
And going in front of me, and then I was, you know, trying to get it in, over to another lane, which they thought interpreted that as being trying to overcome their position, and it was back and forth. A little scary for about six blocks, and then I finally turned. I was able to make a turn and get off that street and then get to the theater. Later than I anticipated, and that was my week was highlighted by that little incident.
I'm trying to think of the most unnerving thing to happen to me in a car, and the only thing that pops into my head is when my mother was, it was 1972, so I was 8 years old, and I'm in the back seat of the car, and you remember when McDonald's used to have the Golden Arches were like the big metal, you know, so they went from the front to the back of the building. And they had, we were in McDonald's, and those giant metal arrows that said enter and exit, you know, for the parking lot and all that. And my mother, if you want to freak my mother out, just do anything to her or say anything to her while she's driving. It doesn't matter. Hi, Mom. I'm driving, Paul. Please stop. Or kill us all. So we were leaving McDonald's, and we're leaving, you know, like her proper driving through the where the arrows indicate exit. And we're driving out, and someone is sneaking in next to her trying to get in through the exit arrows, which just made my mother apoplectic, you know, that you're not observing this policy, you know. And like I said, 8 years old, I remember it like it was yesterday. She rolls down the window, and she has a tendency to use foul language, my mother. But I'll just say effing for the sake of internet radio. Rolls down the driver's side window and leans right out to the guy, and she says, "Didn't you see the effing arrows?" And this guy, without missing a beat, he goes, "Lady, I didn't even see the Indians." And I was just at 8 years old. I was like, "Oh, I'm writing that down. Yeah. That's pretty good."
Just like, that's as good as he had.
Really, but so quick, just right on it. Didn't you see the arrows, lady? I didn't even see the Indians. Ba-dum boom. It was just a brilliant, brilliant, tiny little moment.
And your mother's coming out here soon.
My mother's
she?
Coming out here next. I believe next week. Yeah, she's coming out. She's really looking forward to it. I got to get out of the East, Paul. The
Where
humidity is just terrible.
Where does she live now?
She lives in Connecticut. She lives in Connecticut. She lives in a. It's not a. It's like an over 50 community called. Am I totally spaced on the name?
The over 50 community.
No, Heritage Village. Heritage Village. Okay. And it's actually a huge rolling hills area in Southbury that was all Victor Borgia's estate.
Wow.
And Victor Borgia had an estate there, and this was his home. And they have things like different activities and things in different buildings. So, like, his arts, the barn is now like an art center and all that. But it's a beautiful place. Very, very nice. I will be expecting a check from them shortly by plugging them on the air. Yeah. And you know what? It's wonderful to drive a Ford Fusion to Heritage Village because it's a nice car.
You're cutting in on my territory.
But watch the blue hairs because they'll drag ratio, I'm telling you.
They will
drag you.
I drive a Lexus.
Oh, you do?
And,
yeah.
For years, I used to drive had a Ferrari 308 GTS.
Oh,
and that was
darn.
My car for many years. However, I gave it up finally. I went to the Lexus, and one of my grandsons, Josh, my oldest grandson, proclaimed that it's an old man's car. I said, "Why is it an old man's car?" He said, "Well, it's not the car, but if you play golf and you ride that car, it's the two things combined."
Right.
Either one by itself, you're fine.
Exactly.
Play golf in a Ferrari, you're cool.
Right.
That's one way of looking.
The two come together, they cancel each other out.
Yeah.
Well, that's funny.
Yeah.
That's cute.
Well, we should move into our interview, and as I said earlier in the program, in celebration of the September release of his memoirs, Killing Me Softly, My Life in Music, our first guest is a Grammy and Emmy Award-winning composer who will make a rare Los Angeles concert appearance. Am
Absolutely.
I right?
Yeah.
And it's coming up at the Magic Castle in Hollywood on September 28th. And here is a sample. Before we go into the interview, I just want to give you a sample of a little tune that this man wrote the melody for.
I think a few people might recognize this. You think?
I think so.
Let's give it a shot.
Sunday, Monday, happy days. Tuesday, Wednesday, happy days. Thursday, Friday, happy days. The weekend comes. My cycle hums. Ready to race to you.
gray sky, hello blue. There's nothing can hold me when I hold you. Feels so right, it can't be wrong. Rocking and rolling all week long. Sunday, Monday, happy days. Tuesday, Wednesday, happy days. Thursday, Friday, happy days. Saturday, what a day. Grooving all week with you. These days are ours. Sharing the dream. These days are ours. Happy and free. These happy days are yours and mine.
These happy days are yours and mine.
Happy days.
I'm curious about the process, Charles, about Michael, do you mind if I jump right into this? Because I'm fascinated by this process. When you write something, you've known for so many of these television theme songs, Happy Days and Love Boat and Love American Style just being a couple of them. What is the process like? Are you shown episodes? Is the theme of the show just sort of discussed with you? Because I know that, like, for Happy Days, for instance, I think the first season it was Rock Around the Clock, wasn't it?
Actually, Happy Days started off as an episode of Love American Style, believe it or not.
Oh, it did?
You know, Love American Style had three complete stories within its hour. And one of them at one point was called Love and the Happy Days. And ABC decided not. ABC loved Love America Style, by the way, for that reason, because they could duck the whole cost of a pilot into an episode of skits, segments, I should say. In this case, they decided not to put it on. They felt the world wasn't ready to revisit the 50s until George Lucas came along with American Graffiti, and they decided to put it on as a series. So I was asked to do the series and to write the theme song. First of all, when I'm involved with the show at the beginning, there's nothing really beyond the first, maybe a pilot. I could get involved even before the pilot, but it's usually a pilot episode that I would see. So it's the beginning, and you never know all the twists and turns the show's going to take. I mean, the Fonz, for example, didn't become as popular until the second year.
Right.
When the show shifted. Yeah. The first year was...
He's barely in the first few episodes. They're just sort of, like, isolated.
Well,
just
it was Ron Howard's show, basically.
Right.
But then after the first year, I know this doesn't answer your question exactly, but after the first year, there were so many cards and letters about the Fonz, they decided to do it as a four-camera live show, which the first year, it was just a film show.
Right.
So the song that we wrote in the first year, but they didn't use it until the second year. And that was because Rock Around the Clock was used in American Graffiti, so I think they thought that they would just hedge their bet and use that song. They did use our song as an end title right away.
Okay. Well, Rock Around the Clock, they not only had that in American Graffiti, but they had Ron Howard in American Graffiti.
They did.
Yeah, so those are the two tie-ins there. Yeah,
they did, yeah. Yeah. But Happy Days, of course, was very much its own series. And yeah. Beloved series, I think it was on the air for 12 years or something.
You know, we recently had Linda Pearl on the show.
Mm-hmm.
Linda said, told us an interesting story that when they were casting that role of Fonzie's, you know, girlfriend, the one that he was going to be with, that the network went looking. The casting notice went out to get a Linda Pearl type to play that part.
Oh, I guess, yeah.
And the agent called and said, "But what's wrong with Linda Pearl?"
Yeah. I think that's kind of heartbreaking. I mean, you probably
but typical,
know a lot more than
typical.
Yeah.
Yeah. People, so she ended up, of course, getting.
Well,
the
she ended up getting the role, so it has a nice ending because you know she was used as the model and then ended up being offered the role. So
do you know, Charles? Do you have a sense when you write something like this, you're involved in a project like that? Do you have a sense that it's going to be something very special and that it has a chance to become something even iconic as it has become?
Honestly. It's hard to know that. But, however, I approach every show as though that's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I did the theme for... My very first theme for television was Wide World of Sports. Right. And ABC had no idea that they had something that was going to go on there for 30 years. They weren't sure that it would be a success at all. But, every show has its own need musically.
Right.
And it's up to me or whoever the composer is to get into it and find out what will bring out that so that when people hear the theme, they'll... If they're at the refrigerator and they hear the theme of the show, they come running back, you know, because they like the show. And a real identity.
Right, sure.
So
I
always believe that that if you do a real strong identification musically, and visually as well, by the way, that that's kind of a hook for a show.
Now, like in terms of Wide World of Sports, which is such iconic music, like the minute you hear that, it's what you think of. Were you given, were you provided the voiceover when you wrote that? Did you know that that voice, you know, the thrill of victory and the agony of defeat?
That.
So
I
you did.
Did
know that. So do you compose that for your... The way you work the process, do you compose that like a song, as though the spoken voiceover is just a lyric, or is it any different?
No, that's the only singular case I can think of.
Really?
I also did Monday Night Football, the original Monday Night Football. I don't recall what they said, but I mean, the thrill of victory, the agony of defeat has become very iconic, too. By the way, written by a friend of mine who passed away a few years ago, Stanley Ralph Ross. He was a great writer.
No,
we didn't know each other at the time, but we became friends.
Cross paths later on.
Yeah. I mean, every show has its own needs, and everyone has its own things to bring out musically, and it is a process.
Michael and I were talking before the show, as we always do, when Michael's not drag racing, and when he's available, because normally he's drag racing. But I'm very curious about songs and how an artist gets attached to a song. And the example that I use when Michael and I were discussing it is Roberta Flack and Killing Me Softly, which is your
beautiful
song.
Beautiful.
And that pairing, it's just that, did you know that you were writing that she would be recording it? Is it just a song? I don't mean to say just a song, like to belittle it.
I understand.
But do you know when you're writing for a particular artist, do you... How does that process work, really? I'm just fascinated by that.
Actually, Norman Gimbel and I wrote that song for a young artist named Lori Lieberman.
Oh, wow.
And that was Lori's first album. And we were looking for a voice, Norman and I, looking for something. We had written songs together in motion pictures and television, but we were looking for someone to develop, to write in a style that we thought would we'd like to work in. And we found Lori Lieberman, a young, wonderful, beautiful singer with a kind of a deep, rich voice, and we started to produce her records, and that actually was the 10th song that we had on the first album of Capitol Records, and Capitol Records called us when 9 songs were complete, and they said they really want to get this record out, and Norman had a book of titles, of ideas for songs, just things that he would mull over, and he thought for a second and said, well, what about a song called Killing Me Softly with His Blues? And we liked the Killing Me Softly part, but the blues sounded old-fashioned, even in 1971 or 72, whenever it was. So he thought for another second and said, well, what about Killing Me Softly with the song? And that opened it all up. So he went back that night. He wrote the lyric. He called me on the phone, and I set it to music that night. And next morning, we had a song, and we were in the studio the very next day. What happened with Roberta Flack was, among the things that Capitol did to promote the album, they got it programmed on American Airlines. Now, these days, we all come onto the airplanes with iPods and iPhones and iPads and
right.
All the iThings. You know? those days, if you want to listen to music on an airplane, you're pretty well listening to what they pre-programmed.
Right.
So Lori Lieberman's album was pre-programmed, and Roberta Flack heard it. She was kind of a prisoner of ours, 35,000 people. I didn't know Roberta Flack at all. I mean, she had just won the Grammy Award. I never had a hit record before. So none of those things occurred to me, what could possibly happen.
Right.
Fortunately for me and for us, Roberta heard it on the airplane, and, you know, she wrote the foreword for my book, by the way.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah, and I think she tells even the story in the foreword. But when she heard it on the air, she loved it immediately. She took out pencil and paper, started writing down the notes and the words. She said she listened to it 10 times. And then when she got to New York, she called Quincy Jones. She had just done a concert with Quincy in California, and she said, how can I get in touch with Charles Fox? And Quincy gave him my number. And I was walking through the music library, Paramount Pictures, and someone handed me a telephone and said, here, this is for you. And the voice on the other end of the line said, hi, this is Roberta Flack. We haven't met, but I'm going to sing your song. So much for fate, you know.
Oh, just
wow!
Plus, if Roberta had flown on United Airlines that day, I'd have no career, I suppose.
Wow!
Oh man, it's fortuitous that I didn't realize when I was telling the story, but it is, and I'm not just blowing smoke here. It's my mother's favorite song. Mother's favorite song.
Well, tell her that I appreciate that.
And she's not internet savvy, but she gets a disc from me every month with the archive shows.
You know, can I tell you what's so nice? I had the very good fortune to be able to say, with some of my songs, that have reached a worldwide audience. The cards, the letters, the impression it makes on people. You know, it's a song is basically a 3-minute, 4-minute thing, and it's interspersed between other 3- and 4-minute poetic statements set to music. You know,
all right.
So you have to feel so fortunate and lucky when something like that stands out on its own. But then you hear from people about what meaning it has when people fell in love to a song, or they,
sure,
or they got divorced to a song. Who knows? But I mean, it has personal meaning to people.
Well, it's a soundtrack to your life. I mean, I remember things by songs. I remember things by, you know, and looking at me, you'd think I'd remember things by smells. But it's actually more audio for me. That's where, when I go back and, you know, I remember, oh, this was the summer that I listened to that album.
And that happens with television also, because I think we all relate to points of our lives in terms of what television
shows we
remember growing up or whatever. And of course, I hear that from a lot of people.
I'm overwhelmed when you stop and think about the songs that you've written, for example, and Happy Days, again, going back to that, and Love American Style, and Laverne and Shirley, and so many others like that, that there's probably hardly a person in the civil world that has not been touched by that one of your songs.
Well,
that's phenomenal.
That,
you know, when you think about that,
yeah,
right?
It's there. I mean, we've used the term iconic already today, so I hate to repeat it, but it's just pop culture. People are just embrace. And I know this was Penny Marshall's add-on to your opening, the Schlemiel Schlemazel Hassan right. Pfeffer Incorporated. It was a game she used to play. Is that what you...
What I heard...
you would know better than I sir, know. So please do
I would
tell.
Say that, it was Gary Marshall created that show, and along with Tom Miller and Eddie Milkus, who produced a lot of the shows together.
Right.
And I had the good fortune to have a lot of that ride with those guys, and they were great memories and great guys. when they were... Laverne and Shirley was just a quick spin-off of Happy Days. The two girls came on to the show and as a sort of love interest for the Fonz and Ron Howard. And they just did a couple of scenes, but ABC got so many cards and letters and calls that they decided that they might have something here. Maybe we can follow it with a quick spin-off, you know. So we didn't even do a pilot. We just did a 20-minute presentation. But the one thing that Gary Marshall and Miller and Milkus really left to do was do a whole visual and main title with a whole sound to it, the song. So we were asked to write a song. And in answer to your earlier question, we didn't really know who the characters were, which usually you'd know pretty well who they were.
Right.
We just knew they were two girls. And I'll tell you something interesting. The first song that we wrote didn't work for them because they described that these two girls would be working in a brewery in a factory in Milwaukee, which is where Tom Miller had lived and grown up, which is why they were set in Milwaukee.
Right.
And they were dreaming and hoping about getting out of the factory and doing something in their lives, you know. So we wrote a kind of dreaming and hoping song and wishing. And because it was all so new, the producers heard that and they said, gee, that's a great song, but it's not our characters. It doesn't feel like our girls. Our girls would go out and take the world by the, you know, by the horns, and they would make things happen.
Right.
So we wrote Making Our Dreams Come True. And it's a slight shift between wishing our dreams come true and making them, but it's a whole different song.
Sure, yeah.
Schlemiel Schlemazel, Hassan Pfeffer Incorporated happened because when they were shooting on the set at Paramount lot, just the girls fooling around, and they just did a quick pilot, you know, a quick presentation. And Tom had the idea of a camp song that he remembered from his camp. Now, maybe it was Penny's camp. I don't know.
I
could have gotten it backwards, but I recall.
I'm going to trust your story over mine.
if Penny said, I'm not going to argue with Penny. But I just recall, and maybe I did get it backwards. I recall there was Tom who said that, but it hardly matters. It's just become a landmark in television, one way or the other.
Wow. And you know, we can't omit this part of Charles's life because he has a new book that is coming out, that has come out actually this month, Killing Me Softly, My Life in Music, and Scarecrow Press. And it is, will be on sale at the Magic Castle for your concert as well.
Well, so. You said I'm going to make a rare appearance. It's actually my first appearance.
That's your first appearance.
Well, you can't get much rarer than that.
That's as rare as you get, yeah. No, I mean, I've done a lot of that, but never at a whole act. I've done, like, you know, I produce, for example, a show every year for the benefit of the Film and Fund. It's a wonderful organization. It's
right.
About 2,000 children, where I ask my friends, some of the great songwriters like Neil Sedaka and David Foster and Carol Bay Sagrin, you know, a lot of people, and Paul Reiser was a host this year, and we do a show in June with about 7 or 8 of the really top songwriters, and then I'll do, you know, maybe 10 to 15 minutes along with everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
But this one I'm going to do, I am the headliner, as they say.
You are the headliner. Well, you know what I found fascinating about reading the press material about your book is that a very significant portion of your book is based on letters that you wrote to your mother when you were in Paris studying to be a composer. Is that right?
Exactly right. Yeah, I had a very good fortune in my life to, at a very early, wonderful time in my life, to go to Paris and to study with Nadia Boulanger, who was... probably the greatest composition teacher of the 20th century. She taught Aaron Copland.
Wow.
40 years before me, and generations of composers, and even Quincy Jones, by the way, and Michel Legrand, but generations of classical composers around the world. And I went there at 18 years old to for the summer. There was a conservatory in the Palace of Fontainebleau called the American Conservatory. And I went there just for the summer, and she asked me to stay on and study with her in the winter. And I said, I really, I don't know if my parents could afford that. She said, well, even if they can send you a minimal amount of money, she said, I'll help you. And I never actually paid her for a lesson in all the years I was with her. She was that kind of a person, you know. It wasn't like a scholarship. It was just that she was this fantastic teacher, and she saw my need to want to learn, you know. And I was very eager to learn. So I would see her 3 or 4 times a week, actually, for lessons.
Goodness. And you certainly went on to work with some of the greatest names in entertainment. Jim Croce, who was actually, we share this in common, in my history of public relations, which is the foundation of my company, I represented Mr. Croce.
Oh, did you?
At the end of his life, though I didn't know it at the time.
Right.
And you wrote one of his great songs.
Well, we were very fortunate with that, too. He had a song called coming up called Operator, his first song.
Mm, right. Yeah.
And Norman Gimbel and I wrote a song for a picture called Les American Hero. It was Jeff Bridges' first movie. And we needed to find the right voice to sing that song. And we liked his voice even before it was a big hit. But we needed a quick answer because the picture was coming out, and we had to get a record. And we thought his record would go far, which obviously it did.
Oh.
So we called him up and played it for him over the phone, which is very out of the ordinary to play for a singer to commit to a singer song and be his next record. It wouldn't happen today. It just wouldn't happen.
Right. Yeah.
But he made that immediate connection with the song. He tied it in his own father. And I made the track in Los Angeles on the lot of 20th Century Fox, and I brought the whole track, never having met him. I got his key over and listened to his record, you know. And this was the last song that he worked on, actually, and he was a wonderful guy, and a true legend. And he wrote, and actually when I met him for the first time at his producer's office, you might have known them, Terry Cashman and Tommy West.
Yes.
So the first thing
Conscious Jim West.
Yeah. So the first thing that Jim said is, "Can I hear that song again? I only heard it that one time." So I sat at the piano and I played it for him, and he told me how moved he was and how it reminded him of his father and all that. And then he said, "Can I play a new song for you?" And he played a new song that he just wrote called "I Have to Say I Love You" in a song. So it was just a nice moment that I always remember between two songwriters. Getting back to your question about the letters, however, the letters were the letters I sent home while I was living in Paris, and those remained in a shoebox in my mother's dresser drawer for all those years, and we only discovered them a few years ago.
My goodness.
And when we did, my kids were very interested because, it was about their father at age 18, 19, 20 years old. But that opened up the whole memory box for me, you know, talking about those letters. And so that's kind of the central part of the book. And the rest of the book is my life before Paris and then my life after Paris.
Well, and you've worked with people like Lena Horne and Fred Astaire and Barry Manilow and you name it. I'm in awe, sir.
We're
in the middle of midst of greatness here.
Pleasure to have you here.
All those stories are in the book. All about the Fred Astaire stories.
The book is available to be purchased, and you can do that easily by just going on the internet and probably stopping in at your local bookstore as well. And also, if you would like to read about him, go see him in concert as well at the Magic Castle coming up Tuesday, September 28th. Doors open at 6:30, showtime 8 p.m. It's the Inner Circle at the Magic Castle on Franklin Avenue in Hollywood. And tickets are available by contacting boxoffice@magiccastle.com or simply calling 323-851-3313. I'm going to say that again, 323-851-3313.
And one more time, the title of the book is Killing Me Softly, My Life in Music by Charles Fox.
Thank you. If you go to I have a website for the book, by the way. It's killingmesoftly.com. It'll tell you a lot about it.
Killingmesoftly.com.
There you go.
Beautiful.
There you go.
Thank you so much.
Sir. We're going to read an arts calendar. You'll stay with us, though, of course.
Great pleasure to be here. Yeah.
Wonderful. And, Paul, shall I kick this off?
Why don't you kick off the arts calendar, Michael?
All right. Civic Light Opera of South Bay Cities proudly presents the 1960s girl group musical Beehive. Big Hair is back, and so is the infectious sound of the girl groups and female singers who rocked radio listeners in the 1960s with hits like My Boyfriend's Back, Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow, and Don't Sleep in the Subway. Hailed by the New York Times as pure, irresistible fun, Beehive is a hit parade of divas from Leslie Gore and the Supremes to Petula Clark and Tina Turner. So grab your Aquanet and go-go boots and get ready to party now through October 3rd at the Redondo Performing Arts Center in Redondo Beach, California.
Cloris Leachman's dynamic one-woman show draws from the magical moments in her professional career and personal life. The show is everything you'd expect from the unique, multi-talented Cloris Leachman, who appeared in such films as The Last Picture Show, phenomenal movie, for which she received the Academy Award as Best Supporting Actress, and Young Frankenstein, Frau Blücher. How was that? Pretty?
That was very good. I thought I was going to do the horse, but
what?
You did it.
No, I heard you practiced the horse earlier. It was more like a squid.
Oh.
She also starred on Broadway opposite Katharine Hepburn. Cloris Leachman, a one-woman show, is on stage September 23rd through September 27th at the Laguna Beach Playhouse in Laguna Beach, California.
Wednesday, September 22nd at 7:30 p.m., Pat Boone will perform in a world premiere of a show set to tour the country looking back on his 50-year-plus career, including 44 million records and 38 top 40 records. Pat tells his life story along with family and showbiz film clips, photographs, and stories in a benefit performance for the Society of Singers, and their web address is singers.org. Don't miss Pat Boone at the Skirball Cultural Center in Los Angeles.
As always, you can read about any of these productions on our website, stateoftheartsla.com. That's stateoftheartsla.com. But we also suggest dropping at performingartslive.com, where you can search for Southern California events in several different categories happening every day of the week. And we are grateful to have them on board.
And you know, Paul, we had a guest in here, and Charles, you'll appreciate this too, a guest in here last week, a young man, 24 years old, by the name of Eric Bergen, who was one of the Jersey Boys in the Las Vegas production of the show for 3 years. He also toured nationally in the show, and including the sit-down here in Los Angeles at the the Amundsen Theater, forgive me. And I went to see his concert at the Magic Castle to review it. And I want to tell you, I mean, he has a very wonderful sense of humor and a great sense of spontaneity. And at 24, anybody that's that on top of their game, as we will attest to in this studio, we were just
having great. I saw him at the show. He's terrific.
Yeah. Yes, yes. Oh, what a showman this guy is. Yeah, and his act was every bit what you would expect of someone that had that kind of personality, but, you know, being
years
on this.
Older, years.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, that's exactly. That's a very.
And to be able to cultivate that into, you know, his persona at 24 and pull it off.
Pretty amazing.
Was amazing. I mean, it was like he had been doing this act for 10 years, easy. And just that, you know, savvy kind of. Classy kind
it's
all, of way
it's
of
old
performing.
School. It's like it's martini
school.
Glasses and that sort of style that just sort of hip. Sort of, you know, without being affected. It doesn't seem put on. It seems very genuine. It seems like he was born about 40 years too late.
Right.
You know?
Razor sharp sense of humor. He had wonderful guest stars with him and a band that just cooked, you know, through the whole hour plus set and had the audience, of course, on their feet at the end of the show. So
makes me very nervous to do this now.
Oh, no. You have nothing to worry about. Nothing to worry about. But I do take my hat off to young Eric Bergen. Hope you're listening, Eric. We enjoyed it immensely. Another show that I saw, Paul Strolling.
Yes.
I'm going to stroke you a little bit here, if you'll pardon
the
expression.
It's a good thing it's radio.
I went to the opening of Seaglass Theater's production of Grapes and Nuts.
Yes.
Which is a satirical parody of John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath and of Mice and Men.
Yes.
And it is the West Coast premiere of a show that was done in Chicago, which is where Paul is from, 20 years ago. And Paul was a cast member in the show 20 years ago. Now he's managing director of one of the most distinguished Los Angeles theater companies called Sea Glass Theater. And Saturday night was the opening. And I want to tell you, Paul, you did a pretty nice job.
it went not only directing,
but you brought a beautiful show and mounted it with some fabulous actors.
I saw it too, and I thought it was great.
Oh, thank you, Sam.
Just great.
I'm so glad.
A lot of nuts up there.
I've got to see it now.
It is a hoot.
It is pee in your pants funny.
That's what it is.
Really.
It is hilarious.
You know, it's interesting, and I don't want to eat into your time, Stan, so I'll keep it brief, but it was... what's most fun about the show is that it's not a parody of one or the other. Both the stories are combined. Yeah. So Lenny from Of Mice and Men is actually going to California with the Jode family. And
That's hysterical.
Tom Jode is also George, the caretaker, takes the role of... And I'm telling you, Saturday night was our opening. It went beautifully. We got a fantastic review today from Don Grigware on Broadway
cast,
World.
Wonderful cast.
And just tight, you know, yeah. I mean, it's less than 2 hours, and it just flies by, and people just had a ball. And you know those Steinbeck fans in the audience because you hear that anticipatory laughter when the bit is coming up and when they just see it take a turn, you know, for wherever, and it's so dry and so deadpan, and we just had a ball with it. Michael, thank you for
speaking so favorably
about it.
I'm going to go to see him.
Well deserved. Please do. Let Paul know. He'll take care of it. He's the big cheese over there, you know.
But on to Stan, because I'm very, very excited to talk to Stan, because I'm, in addition to many other things, we were talking about television earlier in the waiting room here, and I'm one of the greatest, biggest Carol Burnett fans.
Burnett, there's no one like her. There's no one like her. She's such a bitch. No, that isn't true. No, let me tell you a little story.
We're taking that sound bite now. Yeah, we're just going to isolate
marketing that.
No, let me tell you a story about Carol Burnett. I joined the Carol Burnett show toward the end of the first season. There were like six more shows to do. And I was the only one that joined at that time. And we rehearsed at Television City. Monday through Friday. Monday we rehearsed in Studio A then. It's huge studio. I went in to work with Ernie Flatt and the dancers. And in the corner, way in the corner, was Carol and Vicky and Harvey and Dave Powers. And they were rehearsing their business. I had nothing to do with her. The second morning, Tuesday morning, I get in. You get in on the ground floor of CBS. And I'm the only one in the elevator. The elevator stops on the first floor. Carol is there. It's only her. She's got a paper bag. She's got her coffee. She gets in the elevator. She looks at me and she says, "Hi, Stan. How are you getting along?" For the star to take the time to learn what the new dancer's name was.
Right.
I mean, whatever she did after that.
Right.
And she maintained a warm, warm person to all of us throughout, because I finished the 11 years.
Really?
And I got to act on the show as well, so that was fun.
There was just such an integrity to television then. It was just that there were, you know, because there were so fewer choices, the cream really rose to the top. Now there's 6 million channels. You're gonna, you know, I want a television show about dwarves who albino dwarves who golf, and you'll fill a season
You'll find anything. Fortunate, I guess.
Yeah.
But in a way, a lot of wonderful shows get lost.
Yeah. But it just
so much of it.
But it's not just. I want to point out the credits here, Michael. It's the Broadway credits. High Spirits with musical adaptation.
My first show.
Was that the first one?
Yeah, B. Lily, Tammy Grimes.
Oh man,
wonderful. B. Lily, Beatrice.
And now
Lady Peel.
Holly Go Lightly. Sorry, Mary Tyler Moore. Was that a musical of?
That was the musical of Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Right. Yeah.
They we did it in Philadelphia and Boston. And interesting, in Philadelphia. We were told, and we got fabulous reviews in Philly, but they compared Mary Tyler Moore to Audrey Hepburn in the movie, because she comes out looking gorgeous in a gown with long gloves and everything. They read the reviews with the comparisons. The next performance, she was in a trench coat, brown paper bag, looking at Tiffany's. I mean, they didn't know what to do with the show. We went to Boston. They fired the dancers at the end of the Boston run. They fired the Abe Burrows. They Truman Capote said, the only one that I will let touch my show now is my good friend Edward Albee. So it became Who's Afraid of Holly Golightly? No, truly. I mean, it's a shame. They just didn't know what to do with it.
Who's Afraid of Holly Golightly?
And they never opened the show in New York. They never opened it. Oh, no, because Mary, God bless her, she was so wonderful. But he had written an abortion scene in the play where Richard Chamberlain was saying, come on, Holly, we can start over. We can start again. The hecklers in the audience would say, yeah, why don't you start the show again? I mean, she ran to David Merrick and she says, I can't do this anymore.
Oh, man.
She's absolutely, that's what she said. I cannot do this again. So they never really opened.
Wow. And that was, of course, after her fame on television, right?
Yes.
But she's an old hoofer. Yeah. She started as a dancer.
Do you know that she was the on the Richard Diamond TV series? You remember that, Charles?
I think I do. Let me see. Am I right?
She was the legs.
She was the legs.
You like my English?
She was the
she
legs.
She was the legs. Yeah. She were the legs?
There was the secretary. Her legs. The secretary that you only saw the legs in the opening credits. Or sometimes she spoke on the phone and you just, but they were her legs. And fine legs.
Fine legs they were.
Well, the girl had some stems.
A sweetheart she was. When we finished that show and moved out here, I was invited to her house because a very good friend of hers who took care of her, like I guess her secretary, was this woman who was very good friends with me. And so consequently, she invited me to the house, so I went to swim in the pool and everything. Mary couldn't have been nicer.
Stan, you're very blessed in that you to not only work with these incredibly talented people, but just these two first examples, Carol Burnett and Mary Tyler Moore, are known just as well for their kindness and how well they treat the people that they work with.
I only work with really wonderful people. I don't know what I'm doing.
Well, you're here with us.
I don't know what I'm doing.
Bada bing, where's that drum set?
I don't know. I should have
brought the rim shot machine.
Well, Stan has something else going on in his career right now, and he's become one of Los Angeles' more popular directors here, doing a lot of our Equity Waiver Theater and associated with the group Rep at the Lonnie Chapman Theater out here in the San Francisco Valley.
Great group of people.
Yeah, it's a terrific group. I've been a member of that group for a long, long time. And when I joined, there were only 20 members. Now we're some 80-some members.
Oh, really?
And it's a great group, very eclectic, the talent. And I've acted there, I've danced there, I've choreographed there, and I've directed there. So it's a great out for my abilities when nobody hires me. So I keep my juices blowing.
Yeah, very much.
So you're doing Neil Simon's Barefoot in the Park.
Barefoot in the Park. I couldn't be happier doing that because I read the paper and I get so depressed of the things and listen to the news. I get so depressed and I think it's a good time for Neil Simon to come back. I wish he were coming, I think, every year, no matter what. Bad Neil Simon is better than a lot of other people's best work.
Right.
This certainly was from his prime. And Barefoot in the Park is, we're just having a ball doing it. And we're opening it up this Friday. I love the
people. You are? September
24th
through October 31st?
Yeah. We play weekends only. We're Equity Waiver. And I just love the cast. Love the cast. And I love that theater. I would do anything for that theater.
I was an Ovation voter for a year, and I remember seeing wonderful shows over at the Lonnie Chapman. And it's a great little space. And it's just one of... It's a little like the Victory that we talked about, that it's just like it's pure. It reminds me actually of like a Chicago storefront theater. It's like the classic, I love the space there.
Just a little larger. We have like 92 seats, I think.
Right.
Well, to go see this wonderful production of Barefoot in the Park, do so by going to the grouprep.com website. Or for tickets, you can call 818-700-4878. Again, 818 area code 74878.
We should also mention a couple of things which are so important here in Los Angeles. There's early bird lot parking and street parking available because that's always a factor.
Huge.
And it is the Lonnie Chapman Theater is at 10900 Burbank Boulevard in North Hollywood and is wheelchair accessible, which is good to know.
Yeah, you all come down.
You all come down.
Well, good luck with that.
That's my show. Y'all come down now.
Right. It sure is. It's a wonderful show.
Well, now we come to a very special time, gentlemen. in the program where we initiate you as guests of State of the Arts.
Yes.
And we are asking you to tell all of us in the theater, the performing arts, have had moments in our careers.
Whether on stage or off. Yeah,
right, but on or off. Yeah. That were like the worst moments ever to happen, and probably hilarious at the same time, and sometimes not. But Charles, we'll start with you. You look like you're.
I could see Stan's got the wheels turning.
You have to have some nightmare story of your that's happened to you on stage, live television maybe, or during a taping or something.
Well, nightmare as a dancer. I was doing High Spirits, and I had done it like 5 months, 6 months at the time. And Don Percassi, who did the original Al DeLuca in Chorus Line, okay, he's right next to me. We're getting ready for the big number one finale, you know, Faster Than Sound. We're ghosts, and we're getting ready to jump onto this terrace. And he turns to me and he says, Stan, what foot do we start on that combination on the left or right? And I said, I'm doing it by rote now. I said, well, I think it's the left foot. I think, and then we were up. We were already on stage then. We got to the place on stage left. I started something on my left foot. I had no idea what I did for that whole count. I was doing something completely different than the rest of the group. We got in the wings, and I said, Don, don't you ever do that to me again. And he's laughing, yeah. Couldn't be laughing more. So that was a little humiliating for me, but fortunately, no one really saw it except
just
the people
completely
in the show.
At the moment,
through.
Just
was,
going through
I
it at the
ass.
Moment.
I was a complete
yeah.
ass on stage.
I'm reminded of something. I want to share a story of my own here. I was doing Tony and Tina's in Chicago, and the first production of Tony and Tina's, it was in Chicago, and I was Vinnie Black, the Cadillac of caterers. He was an annoying Italian character, so to prepare for that, I followed myself around for a year. And there's a bit where one of the groomsmen has a fake joint rolled up, and it was tea, because if you burn tea, it smells just like marijuana.
So didn't know that.
Yes. Yeah, so you just take the first stage and stuff. If you take like Lipton tea and you roll it up and you burn it, it smells exactly the same. So there was a bit where they would go into the back of the like the storeroom in the theater, because it was all interactive. And he would take out this joint, and he would light it, and he would share it with audience members, because it was harmless, of course. And then I would go in, and I would break it up, because it was my place, So I go back there, and they're starting the bit, and then one of the audience members reaches into their pocket and says, oh, why don't we just spark this up? And so the guy who was playing, it was in the cast, said, hey, I'm all over that. So he takes it from him, and now I'm going crazy, because I don't believe in that at all, it being impaired in any way when you're performing or drinking or doing all that. So I'm really militant about stuff like that. So he's smoking it up like crazy, and we go into the dressing room afterwards, so the show's over, and I said, I can't believe you did that. I was yelling at him. It's so unprofessional, so unprofessional. He just looks at me, and he goes, idiot. I gave him the fake one before the show. Funny. So it was just like he was totally pimped me out.
I have to remember that. That's great. Honest officer, I was just smoking tea.
Yeah, yeah. There you go. Yeah.
All right, Charles.
Well, this is really not even about me. However, I was there, and I can tell you the story of what happened that you probably all will know because you've seen it on television. But I was a witness to the event anyway. I was doing arrangements for Ed Ames once for The Tonight Show. And we had just finished rehearsing the band, and he was singing Try to Remember his big hit.
Mm-hmm.
And then someone hands him a tomahawk. He was on the Daniel Boone show.
Yes.
And said, here, throw this. And, of course, I'm Daniel Boone. He never threw a tomahawk. He didn't know which way was up when I done it. But there was an out, which you can all pick a picture now, right? An outlong of a cowboy or a sheriff or something on a wooden wall about 20 feet away. And he said, all right, I'll give it a try. And he kept throwing it, and every time it missed, it just didn't stick in, So after about 10 times, some stagehand came up and said, try it the other way. Normally, I guess you'd think of with the sharp point facing the wall, but turn it around so the sharp point is facing you. So he turned it around, threw it once, and everyone was totally surprised it stuck in. So the stagehand marked the spot, and that was it. After the show, as you know, because the rest is kind of television history, right.
No one was more surprised than Ed Ames that he got it stuck in.
Yeah.
Or where it was stuck in.
Right.
He had a circumcised cowboy on the stage.
Well, I remember that.
He tried to remove it.
Yes,
and Johnny
yes.
Carson wouldn't let him.
You could see it on the clip. He starts to move. Yeah,
I was right there. He tries to move, and every time he moves, Johnny Carson pulled it back. He knew how to milk that moment.
Oh well, he grabbed his arm, and the shake of his head, which we're on radio, we can't. But it's just sort of like, oh pal, you're not going anywhere. You're staying right here with me.
He knew he had a golden moment. He rode that lap. And Ed was so embarrassed. You know, I think it might have been black and white television, but his face was all red.
And then the zinger that Carson comes in with at the very end, which is he just puts the cap or the cherry on the sundae. He just goes, I didn't even know you were Jewish. Carson comes in right at the top. He was Carson just a master.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we want to thank our guests for being here. Charles Fox, Dan Mazin, thank you so much. And
thank
next
you
week, please join us as our guests are the legendary Tony Award-winning dancer, singer, actress Donna McKechnie from the original Company of A Chorus Line. And from the theater stage to Showtime's mega hit series, Queer as Folk, Mr. Scott Lowell will join us.
Scott Lowell will be with us. And gentlemen, thank you both. We are very, very grateful to have you with us.
It's been a lot of fun.
We look forward to...
Thank you for cruising with us today, and now we're going to... Paul, take us out with the ultimate cruise, courtesy of Charles Fox.
I certainly will.
Exciting and new, come aboard. We're expecting you, and love, life's sweetest reward. Let it flow, it floats back to you. Soon we'll be making another run. The love boat promises something for everyone. Set a course for adventure, your mind on a new romance. And love won't hurt anymore. It's an open smile on a friendly shore. It's love. Welcome aboard. It's love.
You're listening to State of the Art with Michael Sterling and Paul Strolley. Right here on LA Talk Radio.